Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it is September 29th, and we're going to have a test 1 week from today. And I think it's going to be, what, 4, 5, and 7, because we've already had a test on chapter 6 already. Okay, so we had a question on ketone bodies. What the heck is a ketone body? Well, there are times when the cell is generating energy, maybe say by anaerobic respiration, and glucose goes all the way to pyruvate, and pyruvate builds up inside the cell, and that's going to stop glycolysis. So pyruvate is exported out of the cell as lactate. Right? So the cell creates lactate that's exported to the cell. It goes to the liver, and the liver can take two lactic acids and put it together to make glucose out of it again. Right, and that goes back to the muscle cell, and the muscle cell can use that glucose to make energy. Right, so there's a little cycle involved. What a ketone body is maybe the same sort of concept, except the ketone body comes from the end result of beta oxidation. All right, so what's the end product of beta oxidation? What's the input to beta oxidation? What's being oxidized? Yeah, lipids, in particular fatty acids, which are really long chain molecules. And how is a fatty acid broken down? Acetyl-CoA, right? It's a two-carbon fragment, so it chops off two carbons at a time. But because it's a two-carbon fragment that, and not a three-carbon fragment like pyruvate or lactic acid, it can't go back in and participate in gluconeogenesis the way that lactic acid can. But there's still energy in that two-carbon fragment. So what the cell tries to do is that it puts two-carbon fragments together to make a four-carbon unit, but that still can't go into gluconeogenesis. There's still some energy there. There might be some tissues that can use that ketone body for energy, like the liver, for instance. If there are sugars available to break that down, then it can re-enter the Krebs cycle, and different organs can use a ketone body as energy. But if you're devoid of sugars in your body because you're starving or because you're diabetic or maybe because you're on one of these weird diets like an Atkins diet where you don't have any sugars in your body, these ketone bodies build up, right? They can't be used for energy, and you excrete them, right, in urine, and they're very volatile, like acetone, you know, is very volatile. If you open up a bottle of fingernail polish remover or what, it just evaporates. All right, so that's what happens to you when you're on one of these really strange kind of diets, like an Atkins diet. Those acetones or ketone bodies, you just breathe out of your body, and so that's basically just breathing lipid right out of your body. So it's actually a very efficient way to lose weight. It's kind of a miraculous way. But the downside is that your body doesn't have a way to make ATP. So how are you going to function without ATP? Not very well. Drive on the wrong side of the road. Won't know the single thing. Might not even know your name when you come in to take a test. All right. So you got to be really careful with those kinds of diets. Okay. So an Atkins diet is sort of like an artificial diabetes mellitus condition, actually. And so always work with a physician or really be educated when you start to play around with a low carbohydrate diet. Never completely cut off carbohydrates from your diet. You always have to have a little bit so that you can make ATP. So that's what the job of those ketone bodies are. It's when acetyl A has no place to go, cells make ketone bodies out of it, and maybe hopefully there's another tissue in your body that can utilize those ketone bodies, or you just lose them. Okay. Yeah, somebody else had a question? Ketones, ketone bodies are four carbon units. Yeah. Okay. Because two acetyl-CoAs are put together. All right. So we were talking about neurophysiology last time, namely an action potential. And an action potential just relates to the electricity that is occurring within a cell, right? And we started by understanding what a resting membrane potential is, but you should know that the membrane potential can change. And when it's in motion, maybe physically down a neuron, or when the voltage is changing across a membrane, we can call that an action potential because something is changing. Something is becoming activated or changing. And then you should know the two main phases of an action potential. What are the two main phases? And maybe there's a couple other phases that we could put in there, but the two main phases, the first one is depolarization, and what ion is that due to?
Sodium.
And what is happening to sodium? It is entering the cell, so that's depolarizing. The cell is negative on the inside, but when a cation enters, it becomes less negative. We call that depolarization. And what's the second part of an action potential? Repolarization. And what ion is responsible for that? It's a potassium. And potassium leaves the cell. Potassium is a cation. And when it leaves the cell becomes more negative once again, right? It recharges. So we call that repolarization. All right. And furthermore, you should probably know what the what's responsible for producing that action potential. What in the membrane is responsible for producing that action potential? Because sodium and potassium can't move across the membrane by themselves, right? Because they're hydrophilic compounds, and so the membrane excludes the transport of hydrophilic compounds. It has to be some kind of lipid compound, and of course cations aren't. What has to be in that membrane to allow sodium and potassium to move? And why only at particular times? So there's channels, there's ion channels, but only at certain times, so that means that there's very special kinds of ion channels that allow for an action potential. What is special about these channels? They're gated by voltage that is applied across the membrane, right? So we call those voltage-gated channels. So an action potential is the result of voltage-gated channels, and a neuron doesn't have those everywhere on the cell membrane. You should know where voltage-gated channels exist only. Where do you have voltage-gated channels on a neuron? On an axon, that's right. So they start to appear right along that axon hillock, that funnel-shaped structure coming from the stroma of a neuron. Okay. All right, so the other two things that you should appreciate about an action potential is that an action potential won't be initiated unless there's a criterion that's met. And what's the criteria? It's got to have the threshold voltage, right? So when you draw an action potential, you should probably draw in the resting membrane potential, the threshold voltage, and then at the end of repolarization, there's another little tail of the action potential that you should be aware of. We call that area of hyperpolarization that produces some kind of refractory period. What kind of refractory period is that? A relative refractory period. So during that time, it takes an above normal stimulus to cause another action potential, right? It's not absolute refractory period. Another action potential can be instituted, but it has to be at a higher level than the first time that that neuron was activated. All right, and as action potential moves along an axon, what about the shape of that action potential? What about the intensity and what about the duration of that action potential? Does it change as it's scooting along an axon? It does not change, right? So we say that it's transmitted without decrement. It does not change. All right, so an action potential is the same at the beginning of the axon compared to the axon terminus, right? So those are all some pretty good things. So let's talk about another kind of electrical event on a membrane, all right? And we call these graded potentials. So let's look at this plot right here of voltage versus time. And here I see a depolarization and a repolarization and a depolarization and a repolarization. And does that look like an action potential to you? Why or why not? Some people said no right away, and that's great. Why not? Because the amplitude is, decreasing as this event moves along an axon. All right, so we call that a graded potential. Graded means what? It can go up and down. It can vary. So this kind of electrical event is not the result of voltage-gated channels. Right? So as a matter of fact, this happens whether there are channels, hardly any channels in the membrane or not. So if we have an axon and we inject some kind of positive current or positive ion into the cell, that's going to create electricity inside the cell, and it's going to propagate Right? These positive charges are going to move through the cytoplasm, but the cytoplasm has resistance. It's going to impede the flow of these ions, plus they leak out, and as they leak out, the amplitude of the signal that we put inside the cell decreases as it moves away from that site where it was stimulated. All right, so we call that a graded potential. And graded potentials are used in neurons all the time by a different set of gated channels. So they're not voltage-gated channels like what produces an action potential. We call these ligand-gated channels because there actually has to be a receptor in the membrane that will be triggered into opening, like a sodium channel will open when it binds a signaling molecule. And we're going to I'll show you what some of these ligand-gated channels are like in just a little bit. All right, so the parts of a neuron that have ligand-gated channels that can produce graded potentials are on dendrites and on the cell body. So dendrites and cell body cannot produce action potentials, but they produce what? Graded potentials. So if there's a receptor that's really, really far away from an axon hillock, right, that cell might be stimulated, but as that signal moves to the axon hillock, what? It dies away, and when it gets to the axon hillock, it might even be a zero voltage right here. Will that produce an action potential at the axon hillock? No, because the zero voltage right here, right, is not going to push the cell up to threshold, and an action potential won't result. Okay. So, let's think about some voltage-gated channels again that actually produce action potentials. All right, so, and I kind of drew this on the board last time. All right, if we have an axon that is not myelinated, if we have an area of depolarization, that depolarization is going to spread right and left. All right, and so it's going to spread over to this region over here, and when this region over here reaches threshold, what's going to happen? An action potential is going to be generated, right? And so that depolarizes this region over here, and when it reaches threshold, that's going to produce an action potential over here. Now, why can't this area of depolarization cause an action potential over in this part of the axon? Right, because it can't go retrograde. It can't go retrograde because this part of the axon is in an absolute refractory period because of that inactivation gate in the sodium channel. Right, as soon as you reach the peak of the action potential, the inactivation gate closes and this part of the membrane can no longer depolarize anymore, but the potassium channels allow it to repolarize. All right, so if an action potential has to move molecule by molecule by molecule down an axon, we call that continuous conduction, and it's relatively slow. It can go at about 2 miles per hour, which is really, really slow. So through evolution, what have neurons figured out how to do to increase the speed of electrical impulse conduction? So an electrical impulse, I don't know if I told you this, but an electrical impulse is just an action potential that's in motion down an axon, right? So an impulse is an action potential moving down an axon. How can biology speed up the rate of that impulse conduction? Well, yeah, it can. Wrap insulation around the axon by using in the peripheral nervous system. What kind of cell will wrap insulation around an axon? That would be a Schwann cell. What's the name of the chemical that acts as insulation? That would be myelin. Yeah, so a Schwann cell produces a myelin sheath. So underneath this area right here, there are no channels for ions to leak across the membrane. So there aren't even any voltage-gated channels. But in between the cells, which we call a node of Ranvier, where there is no insulation, there are voltage-gated channels here. So when this area depolarizes, right, that produces a significant voltage change at this node of Ranvier. So the voltage actually hops across the Schwann cell, causes these voltage-gated channels here to depolarize. So an action potential is generated here, and then another one is generated here. So a nerve impulse actually hops from one node of Ranvier down to the other, all the way down the nerve axon, but nonetheless, it's still transmitted without decrement because there are still voltage-gated channels in these nodes of Ranvier. And so this increases the speed of conduction of a nerve impulse to probably a maximum of about 300 miles per hour. Right, so certainly you can see there's a huge difference between 2 miles per hour and 300 miles per hour, right? That's hundreds of times faster. Well, I wish I could increase my salary by hundreds of times, right? That's a huge increase. And of course, that's a lot better for the nervous system. You can think faster, move faster, control parts of your body much more quickly as a result of that. All right, so that kind of conduction, when it is skipping down an axon, we call that saltatory conduction. So you should probably have on the tip of your tongue, saltatory conduction is a maximum of 300 miles an hour, while continuous conduction is really slow, like 2 miles per hour. And the difference is these myelin sheaths produced by either Schwann cells in the peripheral nervous system or oligodendrocytes in the central nervous system. And our nervous systems are designed around having these proper speeds of conduction along these axons. As a matter of fact, there are certain conditions where somebody's own body starts to reject myelin. It understands myelin to be a foreign substance. So your immune system then starts to attack the myelin sheath, especially in the central nervous system. It attacks those oligodendrocytes, producing plaques around neurons, and that disrupts the communication between different parts of the brain, and we call that multiple sclerosis. So that's the basic underlying feature of MS, or multiple sclerosis. Yeah.
I didn't hear you say, okay, the salutary conduction is 300 miles per hour, whereas the other one was under
200. Yeah, continuous conduction. All right, so continuous conduction. All right, I should probably put that in the slide right here. Continuous. It has to go from molecule to molecule to molecule, right? Because there's no myelin sheath around these axons. Continuous versus, right? And let me say this because the pronunciation, well, it's pronounced just as it's spelled, right? But it's kind of a funny spelling. It's called saltatory conduction. Okay, like table salt. Okay. Up to 300 miles per hour. Very, very fast. Okay. All right, so so on your drawing of the neuron, make sure that you appreciate that action potentials can occur along an axon due to voltage-gated channels, but graded potentials occur on the receiving end of a neuron due to ligand-gated channels. And I'm going to show you some examples of ligand-gated channels coming up in just a little bit. All right, so a synapse is a structural and functional unit of communication between cells in our body. So cells have to communicate for coordination and for maintaining homeostasis. And there are two kinds of synapses, two different ways that cells can communicate with each other. There are chemical synapses and electrical synapses. The cell that is going to be sending the signal is what we call the presynaptic cell, and the cell that's receiving the signal is going to be called the postsynaptic cell. So two cells together, information goes from one to the other. The one that's sending is the presynaptic cell. All right, so synaptic transmission at chemical synapses occurs due to neurotransmitters. So neurotransmitters are chemicals that the presynaptic cell releases, and then they move to the postsynaptic cell, and that's going to cause some kind of response in the postsynaptic cell. The other kinds of synapses, namely electrical synapses, are relatively rare in the nervous system. All right, we find them in a few places, but I'll mention exactly where they exist in muscle. All right, so they are found in muscle to a large degree in certain kinds of muscle. All right, so let's look at an electrical synapse first. Electrical synapse, we see two cells are very, very close together, and there's maybe a little tiny space between them, but that space really is not too significant because the connection between these two cells, let's just say, Let's see if is it labeled one way or the other. No, let's just say that the top cell is the presynaptic cell, the bottom cell is the postsynaptic. So the top cell is going to signal the bottom cell to do something. All right, and how can it do that? Well, we see that there are some special proteins made out of connexins right here that form this tunnel between the two adjacent cells. And this tunnel is big enough to allow a sodium ion to move between these particular cells. These are what we call gap junctions, so that if this presynaptic cell becomes depolarized, right, how would you depolarize this presynaptic cell? Well, on a molecular event, what would have to happen? Sodium is going to have to enter that cell somehow or another, okay? We're going to look at a couple of different ways. All right, and when sodium becomes high inside the cell, it's going to then go through this gap junction because it's low inside the postsynaptic cell. And when sodium enters the postsynaptic cell, what happens to the resting membrane potential of the postsynaptic cell? It depolarizes as well, right? So it becomes stimulated. So because sodium is a cation, and since it can move from one cell to another through a gap junction, that causes that electrical that information is carried as an electrical signal, and that electrical signal can go directly from one cell to the next, stimulating all the cells that are connected together with gap junctions. And where we typically find gap junctions, a really important place, would be in cardiac muscle. All right? So if one cardiac muscle cell becomes stimulated, what happens to the whole heart? If one cardiac muscle cell depolarizes, eventually what happens to the whole heart as a result of that? Because there are gap junctions in all the intercalated discs. The whole heart depolarizes, right? And that's a signal for contraction of cardiac muscle. So when we get to muscle, you'll see how that depolarization is coupled to contraction. And that's a really good thing because we don't want one part of the heart to contract and another part and another part and another part. That's actually what happens when somebody's heart is in fibrillation. And when a heart is fibrillating, it's not pumping. In order for a heart to pump, the whole heart has to contract as a unit, right, to squish blood out, to maintain blood pressure and blood flow. So the heart contracts as a unit because it has these gap junctions right here that allows for depolarization to spread from one cell to another. All right, now skeletal muscle does not have gap junctions, and that's a really good thing. Who could maybe tell me why it's a great thing that skeletal muscle doesn't have gap junctions? Okay, because if you were to say, oh, I need to click this mouse right here, and you move your index finger to click the mouse, what would happen to all the skeletal muscle in your body? I mean, your whole body would contract. All right, so you really wouldn't have very good control over the mouse or anything in your life, right? Because you would just be quivering. Your whole body would be in fibrillation. Okay, so other parts of your body have chemical synapses. All right, so here is a pretty good example of a chemical synapse. So chemical synapses exist between most neuron-neuron connections, but also a connection between a neuron and a skeletal muscle. That's what we would call a neuromuscular junction. All right, so here we see a space between the cells, and we call that the synaptic cleft, and it's filled with interstitial fluid, and electricity can't move from the presynaptic cell into the postsynaptic cell because there's sufficient resistance within this fluid in the synaptic cleft, right? If electricity was to go from the pre into the postsynaptic cell, it would actually have to be something like a lightning bolt. And guess what? We don't have anything like lightning bolts inside our body. We have electrical currents due to ions that are moving one way or the other. Who's ever seen a lightning bolt? Yeah, like up in the sky, or if you're walking along a carpet and you pick up static electricity and you touch something, right, you can see that little spark, right? And we don't use sparks inside our body to transmit electrical information. That's not possible. All right, so how can that information move from the presynaptic cell into the postsynaptic cell? Well, the electrical activity, namely an action potential, coming down a nerve axon, when it reaches this terminus of an axon, you see that it's a little swelling right here. It's a little enlarged. So sometimes we call that a terminal button. or a Bhutan terminale. Okay, sometimes we call it a synaptic knob. But there's a swelling, and this swelling contains a lot of mitochondria, number one, for doing what? Producing ATP energy. So these processes in this Bhutan terminale require a lot of energy. All right, but there are vesicles, and we haven't really mentioned this vesicle before. It's containing something called a neurotransmitter, right? It's a chemical compound. And it requires energy to make these particular compounds. That's why we see a lot of ATP in this region right here. And when the action potential reaches this terminal button, the voltage changes, of course, on the membrane. And here we have another kind of voltage-gated channel. But this is not a sodium voltage-gated channel or a potassium voltage-gated channel. It is a calcium voltage-gated channel. So when the membrane depolarizes, that causes a change in conformation of this calcium channel, and then calcium can enter the cell. Because remember, calcium is high, typically in the extracellular space, and very, very low. All right, so calcium then acts as a signal to activate a compound called calmodulin. And calmodulin, right, when it binds calcium, can turn an inactive protein kinase into an active protein kinase. So what does a protein kinase enzyme do? It adds a phosphorus to other different proteins inside the cell right here, and it's going to activate a whole bunch of other kinds of proteins, which we call regulatory proteins. These regulatory proteins cause the docking and fusion and the release of neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft right here. Okay, so the intracellular signal is calcium that causes the release of neurotransmitter. And neurotransmitter then is at a high concentration at the, what we call the presynaptic membrane, low concentration at the postsynaptic membrane, so it's going to diffuse down its concentration gradient. And the neurotransmitter then is going to bind to a receptor molecule in the postsynaptic membrane. And then one way or another, it's going, after it binds to a receptor, it's going to open up a sodium channel or maybe a potassium channel, thereby adjusting the voltage at the postsynaptic membrane. All right, we're going to look at a couple of different ways that it's going to affect the postsynaptic membrane right here. And the amount of neurotransmitter that's released is a result of how many action potentials reach this axon terminus. So if the stimulus, right, in the dendrites is a very high amplitude, the frequency of action potentials reaching is going to be a high frequency. It will release a lot of neurotransmitter. But if the stimulus on the dendrite of this presynaptic cell is very low, then the frequency of action potentials is very slow. Okay, and then very little neurotransmitter is going to be released. All right, so what I want you to appreciate with a chemical synapse is that information is being transmitted along an axon from dendrite and cell body and then down the axon as an electrical signal, right, as an action potential. And then that action potential has to be converted by this mechanism inside the synaptic knob into a chemical signal. And that chemical signal then, when it binds to receptors on the postsynaptic cell, it gets converted back into another electrical signal. All right, so through a chemical synapse, the information is electrical, chemical, and then electrical once again. But this gives your body precise control over various cells, right? Even maybe one cell at a time, as opposed to a gap junction. Okay. All right, so action potentials travel down an axon to depolarize the Bhutan terminale. That opens voltage-gated channels. Then calcium is driven in by the electrochemical gradient because the Bhutan terminale has a negative charge. Calcium is high outside the cell. Calcium rushes in, right? And that triggers the excitosis of those vesicles releasing the neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft. Okay, and that calcium, all right, works by activating calmodulin, which then activates a protein kinase, And that phosphorylates a bunch of enzymes, which then those other regulatory proteins become activated because they're phosphorylated, which then causes the fusing and docking of that synaptic vesicle with neurotransmitter. Okay, so that's what we call synaptic transmission, right? That's how one neuron can communicate, or that's how a presynaptic neuron can communicate with a postsynaptic neuron. All right, so what ion is necessary for transmitting information across the synapse, which is what we call synaptic transmission? Okay, so you saw sodium and potassium because of the action potential, but what you see here is a new ion. It is calcium, like a number of you have said. All right, so when you've taken an anatomy class, you probably learned that calcium is important where in your body? As a structural component to make bones strong, right? So that they don't compress, so they don't fracture. Here you see that calcium is necessary. The proper levels of calcium are necessary in your body for what to happen? For neurons to function properly so that neurons can communicate with each other. So as a matter of fact, all right, what do you think is a more important place to have calcium? In the extracellular fluid so that you can have synaptic transmission, or in bones so that you can have strong bones? And you know what? You're going to say, well, I don't want to make that choice. But sometimes as we get older, we lose calcium and your body has to make that choice. All right, in order for you to breathe, right, you need to have that diaphragm contracting. It needs to get electrical signals from your brain. All right, so in order for you to breathe, you need proper calcium levels for synaptic transmission. So let me rephrase the question. What's more important, having strong bones or breathing? Yeah, right? So your body makes that choice too, right? And that's what really causes, that's one of the underlying concepts of osteoporosis, right? When your body doesn't have sufficient calcium, it goes to bone. So bone is really a reservoir of calcium so that you can maintain proper synaptic transmission. All right, so how can you protect yourself from osteoporosis? Diet and exercise, right? And it's going to affect women more prevalently than men because men typically can lose more bone because they typically have a little bit bigger, stronger bone structure than women. But even men can suffer from osteoporosis. So it's diet and exercise. Proper calcium diet when you're young, proper vitamin D so that you can absorb that calcium, and exercise, because when you exercise a tissue, what happens to it? Like a muscle. It gets bigger and stronger. The same thing for bone as well, right? And as the bones get bigger and stronger, then you protect them from osteoporosis. Okay, so that's pretty important. So calmodulin, right, is that regulatory protein that binds with calcium. All right, so this receptor protein on the postsynaptic membrane opens, all right, when it binds a neurotransmitter. So the neurotransmitter in this case is what we're going to call a ligand because it binds to a protein on the postsynaptic membrane. So we call these ligand-gated channels. And when a ligand-gated channel gets stimulated to be opened, okay, it can operate in a couple of different ways, right? If a channel opens and it causes a depolarization, right, that's typically how we excite cells when we depolarize the membrane. Can you picture an action potential? Which way is a voltage moving when a membrane is depolarizing? From negative up toward positive, right? So positive ions have to enter the cell. That's what we call an excitatory postsynaptic potential. So when something depolarizes, we call that, instead of saying the whole term, we just say that causes an EPSP. All right, so if a neurotransmitter binds to a receptor that opens a channel and it causes depolarization or an EPSP, can you think of what kind of ion channel is opening? What kind of ion channel opens to cause depolarization? A sodium channel. It's a perfect example, right? A sodium channel, so sodium can enter the cell that depolarizes the cell, right? But that doesn't always have to happen. There could be a special kind of receptor when a neurotransmitter binds to it or the ligand binds to it. It causes hyperpolarization. All right, and when it hyperpolarizes the membrane, how does that drive the membrane with respect to threshold? Does it drive it close to threshold or farther away from threshold? It's farther away from threshold, so that actually inhibits the cell. All right, so how do you make the inside of the cell more negative? What kind of ion could you use to make the inside of the cell more negative? In which way would it have to move? You could take a potassium that's inside, which is what, a cation, open up a potassium channel, it will leave the cell, and now what happens to the resting membrane potential? It hyperpolarizes, moves farther away from threshold, and that inhibits the cell, right? And so that's what we call an IPSP. All right, so these EPSPs and IPSPs then can be used to affect voltage-gated channels later on down the line in a postsynaptic cell. Okay, so EPSPs and IPSPs are graded potentials. They don't travel throughout the whole length of a neuron, right? They're initiated on a dendrite or a cell body. And what can you tell me about a graded potential as they move along the neuron? They die away, right? Just like if you have a bell and you ring a bell, you hit a bell, it's loud at first and then it just kind of slowly dies away. Same thing with a graded potential. All right, so EPSPs and IPSPs are graded potentials. These are not due to voltage-gated channels. These are due to ligand-gated channels. We find them on the dendrite and the neuron cell body only. Right? So these ligand-gated channels then make the dendrite and the neuron cell body the receiving end of that particular neuron because it has to receive a signal. And what's the signal? It's going to be the neurotransmitter from the presynaptic cell. Right, these graded potentials are variable in amplitude. They propagate with decrement, meaning they die away. But because they don't have a refractory period, they can actually summate. So neighboring graded potentials, when they merge together, they can get bigger. Or if you have an EPSP merging with an IPSP, they can actually cancel each other out. So we'll see that in just a little bit. All right, let me take a look at this next slide right here. All right, so write down the answers to these and then we'll do a little graphical exercise. What part of the neuron is the receiving part and why? It's the dendrite and cell body. It has special channels in it, all right, and those are what kind of channels? Ligand-gated channels. So there has to be a neurotransmitter, right, binding to these ligand-gated channels on the dendrites or nerve cell body to either cause an EPSP or an IPSP. Right, what part of the neuron is the sending part of the neuron and why? It's the axon, and it's the axon not because it has ligand-gated channels, but because it has voltage-gated channels. Okay, so some of this information you just have to file away and we'll start to maybe make some sense of these things in just a little bit. Maybe I want to talk about this slide and then I'll talk about it again. So here is an example of a membrane protein. Okay, and we can see that sometimes it's closed. It's not allowing ions to move across the cell membrane. And of course, remember that ions can't move across the cell membrane unless there is a channel that's open in it, right? Because of this lipid region right here. All right, so this membrane channel can change from this closed position to an open position, right? Because it's a ligand-gated channel. And in this particular case, here is a ligand. And it can bind to this active site. And this is on the outside of the cell. Right, and this particular channel, it has to bind exactly two ligands, and when it binds two ligands, it opens up, right, and it allows sodium to enter the cell, causing what for this cell to do? Depolarize, right? So it's going to depolarize the cell, and that's what we call what? An excitatory postsynaptic potential. So this is a ligand-gated channel. It doesn't open and close because of a change in voltage across the membrane. It only opens when the proper signal is applied, and that is what? A neurotransmitter binds to the active site. And on this slide right here, we see that a specific name of a neurotransmitter, that specific name is acetylcholine. So we have these kinds of gated channels on dendrites and cell bodies, not along an axon. Because these are what? Receiving information in the form of what? A neurotransmitter that's coming from the presynaptic cell someplace, causing depolarization. Okay, so let me go back to this slide right here. All right, so here we have a nice neuron. I'm going to have to get my bifocals focused on this slide right here. All right, and so this is kind of similar to the slide that I gave you in your handouts to label. All right, so we got dendrites, right? We got the cell body, and here is an axon terminus, and at the end of this Bouton terminale, we can see what? Release of neurotransmitter right here. All right, so the dendrites and cell body are what we call what? The receiving end, because there are special membrane channels in dendrites and cell bodies. And those channels are called what kind of channels? Ligand-gated channels, because they're always going to be, in a sense, listening for or feeling for or trying to be aware of what? Ligands, which we call neurotransmitters. And when a neurotransmitter binds to them, right, that's going to open up channels that can produce EPSPs or IPSPs in dendrites or cell bodies. All right, so what's a general name for an IPSP or an EPSP? It's going to produce a change in voltage of the membrane, but what kind of change? Action potential? It's what we call a graded potential, right? So the potential change is going to be a result of how much neurotransmitter is being released by the presynaptic neuron right here. Right, so it could be a large graded potential if a lot of neurotransmitter is released. It will be a very small graded potential if there's just a very little bit of neurotransmitter released by the presynaptic neuron. All right, and as that graded potential moves from, say, the dendrite right here over the cell body to the axon hillock, what happens to it? It dies away, right? It slowly goes away because that's the definition of a graded potential. So there are no voltage-gated channels that maintain the propagation of that electrical signal along a dendrite and the cell body. All right, but can you see that all graded potentials, no matter if they originate on this dendrite or this one over here or the cell body, they're all going to be funneled into this axon hillock. All right, so the axon hillock acts as an integrator. It integrates all of the graded potentials that are coming from everywhere on the cell, the soma or the dendrites. They end up in this axon hillock. All right, and if they reach threshold, what happens now on the axon? That starts an action potential moving down an axon. But what happens if you have an EPSP that causes depolarization and an IPSP on another dendrite over here that produces hyperpolarization, right? They both move together to the axon hillock, and when they reach the axon hillock, what happens to them? They merge together, okay, and if one is a depolarization and one is a hyperpolarization, what do? They cancel each other out, and if they cancel each other out, what can you tell me about the threshold, the voltage reaching threshold right here? It doesn't reach threshold, and an action potential then is not transmitted down the axon. So the axon hillock acts as an integration center, adding information together and making a decision on whether it should generate an action potential or not. Right? So every neuron in your body is making decisions all the time as to what information is important to pass on and what information is not important to pass on. So this is just a nice little logic circuit right here. So you have special membrane proteins in this axon hillock that can make that decision. And what do we call those proteins? Those are, do we have it right here? Those are, I should underline it, voltage-gated channels. Because those graded potentials have to reach threshold before an action potential starts. Okay. All right, so synaptic transmission, don't forget, relies on calcium. Right, you got action potentials conducted by an axon, gets down to the axon terminals. This is what the presynaptic neuron. That opens calcium channels. And as a result of a calmodulin and activation of regulatory proteins, that causes release of neurotransmitter that moves across the synaptic cleft where it has to bind, right, to a receptor. So let me show you that receptor again. All right, what can you tell me about the shape of the neurotransmitter right here and the active site that it binds to? It has to match up, right? And if the shape doesn't match up, like if we had another kind of neurotransmitter, we could name a couple, maybe like serotonin, and let's just say serotonin has a square shape. It's not going to bind to this receptor, and therefore it won't open up because the shape is not correct. Right? So there's always a structural and relationship to function in the even at a molecular level right here. All right, so when a ligand binds to receptor, right, there could be an inward diffusion of sodium that's going to produce an EPSP, but maybe it's a potassium channel that opens up, and what's going to be produced in that particular case? An IPSP, or it's going to inhibit that cell. All right, but if it is an EPSP, it's going to produce a graded potential, and it's going to then flow through the cell down to the axon hillock. And if it's at a threshold voltage when it reaches the axon hillock, that's going to start an action potential at the axon hillock, which then will move all the way down the axon to the axon terminus without decrement. All right, so that's a pretty nice slide, but work the handout. I think that's really important for you. Okay, so you got to know what parts of a neuron have voltage-gated channels, which part have ligand-gated channels. So let's talk about some particular neurotransmitters. All right, some examples of neurotransmitters. One very common one is called acetylcholine. It's probably the most widely used neurotransmitter. It's used in the nervous system, in the autonomic nervous system, and somatic nervous system, and even at the neuromuscular junction. Right, and since it's a chemical, what can you tell me about the neuromuscular junction? What kind of synapse is that? Is that it's either going to be a chemical synapse or electrical synapse? And since it uses a neurotransmitter, you're right. Okay, it's a chemical synapse, right? Because a chemical has to go from the presynaptic to the postsynaptic cell. And there are a couple of different kinds of receptors that can bind acetylcholine, all right, and they're labeled either nicotinic receptors or muscarinic receptors. These are subtypes of acetylcholine receptors, and we discovered these because certain receptors can be stimulated with a chemical compound called nicotine, right, and you know where nicotine can be found, and other kinds of acetylcholine receptors are labeled muscarinic receptors because they're stimulated by a chemical compound that's found in mushrooms, and it's called muscarin. And actually those mushrooms are very, very poisonous because that muscarin will bind to these receptors and it's always fatal. Okay, so there are two different kinds of, and we'll see why nicotine isn't immediately fatal. You think it maybe should be. Okay, so there are subtypes of receptors, right? But both contain a neurotransmitter receptor site and an ion channel, right? And they open when the ligand or the neurotransmitter binds to that receptor. All right, so this one right here is an example of a nicotinic kind of acetylcholine ligand-gated channel. It has to bind how many acetylcholine molecules before it can change a state, before the gate can open up? It's got to bind two, all right? And this channel is pretty selective for sodium, but it also allows some potassium to leave the cell. These counteract each other, but by far, much more sodium enters the cell than potassium leaves. So overall, what is produced? Depolarization. And when a postsynaptic cell depolarizes, we say this event is what? An EPSP, excitatory postsynaptic potential, because it's being depolarized by the sodium that's entering the cell. All right, so this is typically how all nicotinic receptors work. So all nicotinic receptors are producing EPSPs or excitatory. And the receptors in skeletal muscle operate basically the same way. They are nicotinic receptors. Okay. Other kinds of receptors, and as a matter of fact, we actually took a look at this for the first test. These are G-protein coupled channels, right? Where the receptor is not part of the ion channel, right? It's a one subunit membrane polypeptide. It can be activated, and once it's activated, it can dissociate, float around in the membrane, and it can then activate a separate ion channel in another location in the cell membrane. All right, so this is a nicotinic muscarinic, this is an acetylcholine muscarinic type channel. All right, and in this particular one, here we see the G protein, here is the receptor, that's an integral protein within the membrane. Notice that there's only one active site for it. So acetylcholine binds to the receptor, which then activates the G protein on the inside of the membrane. All right, so it dissociates, breaks away from the receptor, and the beta and gamma unit can bump into this channel right here, and it's going to cause this channel to open when it touches it. All right, and this particular channel would be a potassium channel. So potassium is going to leave the cell. So what's going to happen with this scenario right here, if potassium is going to leave? That's going to produce an IPSP, which is what? Going to inhibit the cell. It's going to drive it farther away from threshold. All right, so muscarinic receptors always work through a G-protein coupled receptor, but not all of them produce IPSPs. Some can actually cause EPSPs if this channel right here is not a potassium channel, but say it could be a sodium channel, right? Okay, if it's a sodium channel, that would actually cause depolarization. So we're actually going to look at a couple of these different subtypes of receptors, right? But here's a good question for you. This whole mechanism right here, okay, what was my question? My question was, this channel right here, is this a voltage-gated channel? No, it's coupled to this ligand, right? So this is just a nice modified ligand-gated channel. So where would you have this kind of complex? Along an axon or a dendrite? A dendrite, right? Because it's the receiving end, and the receiving signal would be this neurotransmitter or acetylcholine. Okay. All right, well, if acetylcholine is released from the presynaptic cell, all right, and it stays in the synaptic cleft forever, then basically you've lost control of this cell because it's always going to be stimulated or it's always going to be inhibited. So this acetylcholine signal should be degraded. It should go away so that the presynaptic cell can exert influence over the postsynaptic cell again. All right, so there is an enzyme in the postsynaptic membrane that degrades acetylcholine, and that's called acetylcholinesterase, or ACHE. So that terminates the action of acetylcholine because it breaks acetylcholine down into acetate, which you might kind of be familiar with already, right? That's just a two-carbon fragment, and choline. And then those can be taken back up into the presynaptic axon and maybe reincorporated to make acetylcholine, or maybe the cell needs acetate to make fatty acids, or it could metabolize it for energy via the Krebs cycle. Okay, so just because you release acetylcholine, it doesn't mean that this receptor, or it should mean that this receptor is not activated, right, for long periods of time because of this acetylcholinesterase. What about, okay, so acetylcholine in the peripheral nervous system. There are many different kinds of neurotransmitters that we're going to look at. Acetylcholine is one. Norepinephrine is another one. Serotonin and dopamine, we'll look at a couple of these. But all nerves that use acetylcholine as a neurotransmitter are called cholinergic neurons, as opposed to others that use other kinds of neurotransmitters. Right, and that's a very prevalent kind. There is one particular synapse that is huge, right? And we call that the neuromuscular junction. And so that's a junction between a neuron and a skeletal muscle cell. So when a motor neuron releases acetylcholine at these large junctions right here, okay, they always produce EPSPs because it's a nicotinic type of ligand-gated channel. But because the neuromuscular junctions are so huge, anytime a neurotransmitter is released from the motor neuron, it always produces an action potential in the skeletal muscle cell. All right, so there is really no axon hillock that integrates information up. So when a signal comes down from your brain to a skeletal muscle and that neuron releases acetylcholine, what is the only thing that that skeletal muscle can do? Because the neuromuscular junction is so big, so much neurotransmitter is released, it produces a huge graded potential, which always causes an action potential. What does that muscle have to do? It has to contract, right? So skeletal muscle can never make up its mind whether it's going to contract or not. And you're familiar with that. Say, for instance, you have this mouse and you want to click it with your index finger, and you use your mind to move your index finger. Does your index finger ever say, no, I don't want to move? Okay? That never happens because skeletal muscle can't make up its own mind. It's what we say, what? It's voluntary muscle. So at the neuromuscular junction, these large EPSPs always create what we call end plate potentials, which always open voltage-gated channels beneath the motor end plate that cause muscle contraction. Okay, but there are some compounds that can block the neuromuscular junction, like curare. And curare has the right kind of shape to bind to the ligand-gated channel, so curare can bind, where can it bind to? Right here, and it blocks the opening of the sodium channel so that now muscle cells don't depolarize, and if they don't depolarize, they can't contract. So you can imagine what kind of poison that is like, right? So, yes. Oh yeah, you had a little simulation, uh-huh.
Yeah, it still had.
Oh, the nerve, okay, might have an action potential, but it blocks it at the neuromuscular junction, right? So the muscle doesn't have an action potential. So nerves can still transmit, but it can't go across the neuromuscular junction, okay? So it blocks the neuromuscular junction. So that was used as a hunting tool in the people of South America because curare is made by a bunch of plants in South America, maybe even Central America. And then certain insects would eat the plants, they would get curare, and then certain frogs would eat the insects. Right, they would build up curare inside of them and secrete it onto the slime of the frog. And then the people there would harvest some of that slime that was high in curare and coat their little darts and arrows with. And if they shoot that into a big game animal, then that would poison neuromuscular junctions, including the neuromuscular junction at the diaphragm. Then the animal can't breathe, and it's a really handy way of hunting large game. Okay, so that's what curare is used for.
What if you do it to a human?
Oh, not, yeah, that's right. Like,
that way,
well, for instance, like little kids in the tribe could play with arrows and darts and things like that to develop skills, but never poison-coated ones, right? Because if they were to scratch themselves with the arrows, then, of course, they would die. So only specific people within the tribe would have privileges to use that particular kind of poison. Okay, just like today, we have certain people that can use certain kinds of poisons, and we call them doctors. Okay? So you have to learn how to use it appropriately. Right. Okay. Another class of neurotransmitters are what we call monoamine neurotransmitters, all right, which means that they have a single amino group on them. And these include serotonin, norepinephrine, dopamine, and they're derived from amino acids. And there's various kinds of amino acids. Tryptophan is one of them, all right. Tyrosine is another kind. And serotonin is a modification of tryptophan. Norepinephrine, dopamine are modifications of tyrosine. Okay. And amino acids you can kind of group into two general categories. There's a number of different schemes you can use to group amino acids, but does anybody have an idea of how you can take amino acids and group them into two general groups? But maybe before we think of that, what are amino acids used for? What are they a building block of? Proteins, right? You need amino acids to make any kind of protein in your body, right? Whether it's a regulatory protein or structural protein. But you see, you need amino acids to make neurotransmitters. Right? So neurons can communicate with each other only if you have the proper kinds of amino acids in your body. All right, so getting back to the two general classes of amino acids, there are some that your body can synthesize on its own. Yeah. Okay. There are some that your body can synthesize on its own, and then there's some that you can't make. Okay. So the ones that you can't make are what we call essential amino acids. So if you can't make them, where do you get them from? In your diet, right? So essential amino acids you have to have in your diet. The non-essential you can make from other protein sources. All right, and it just so happens that tryptophan and tyrosine are essential amino acids. So what does that mean? In order to have the proper levels of these neurotransmitters in your body, you have to have the proper diet. So diet can influence how neurons communicate with each other because of these essential amino acids. Okay? And these neurotransmitters are what we call catecholamines, are called catecholamines. There are some disease states like clinical depression and schizophrenia, all right, are a result of the inappropriate levels of these neurotransmitters, right? So clinical depression could be a result of improper diet, right, which is really fascinating. We're just beginning to understand this a little bit, right? Now, what kind of diet do you have to get proper levels of essential amino acids? It has to be an animal protein of some kind, right? So people have learned how to circumvent that under certain circumstances. You can be a vegetarian. You can't just eat rice all the time, right? You can't just eat beans all the time because it doesn't have all the correct amino acids. Right, but if you eat beans and rice together, you get all of the essential amino acids like eating a meat protein. All right, so you have to be a little bit educated, and that you pick up from culture, right? Your cultural experiences. What kind of foods you have to combine in the right way to get all of the essential amino acids. Okay. Well, these neurotransmitters are used where? Where are these used at? They're used for communication between cells via what kind of unit? Through a synapse of some kind. And what kind of synapse? A chemical synapse, right? So these are the chemicals that go across the synapse. So let's look at another synapse right here. Okay. So again, we have to have an action potential coming down a nerve axon that's going to open up a calcium channel, because that calcium channel is a voltage-gated channel. That calcium is going to enter the Bouton terminale right here, and that's going to cause the fusion and docking of this synaptic vesicle that contains neurotransmitter, and that's going to be released into the synaptic cleft. It's going to move across the synaptic cleft, but in order to stimulate another action potential on the or any kind of potential, like a graded potential on the postsynaptic membrane, it's got to bind to a receptor. And this receptor you should probably recognize as, it kind of looks like a G protein coupled receptor. It's just not an ion channel, right? So it becomes activated, which is going to activate maybe either an inhibitory channel or an excitatory channel. So monoamines can do both. So these are more similar to the acetylcholine muscarinic channels, not the nicotinic channels. All right, and as acetylcholine is degraded by acetylcholinesterase, norepinephrine, for instance, is inactivated in a little bit different fashion. It is actually taken back up into the presynaptic cell. It's actually pumped from the synapse into the presynaptic cell, and there it is inactivated by monoamine oxidase. All right, so one way that we can increase the levels of these neurotransmitters, all right, is by what? Inhibiting monoamine oxidase, increasing the effectiveness of neurotransmitter in the synapse, or we can actually block the reuptake of it, right? So monoamine oxidase inhibitors or reuptake inhibitors are ways to increase levels of norepinephrine between neurons, right? And so that's a common way that these things are used for antidepressants, because in clinical depression, we can show decreased levels of norepinephrine in individuals. Okay. So I think that also kind of underscores what a nice biological connection between depression and nice treatment modalities, right? Because one of the terrible things about clinical depression is what? It's even today there's a stigma associated with it. A lot of people don't treat it as a disease process, right? It just has this kind of magical negative cloud around it, and that's really unfortunate because people can be treated very effectively. Okay. I do want to say one last thing about that. We still have some time next time before the test. And that is, what is one thing that brains like to do more than anything else? Actually, you're not going to like hearing this, I don't think. But what do brains like to do? What are they really specialized to do? Especially the human brain. Right? They're specialized to learn. Right, so the whole structure of the brain is really geared on learning. I mean, even if you're a little kid, if you have little kids at home, what do they want to do all day long? Oh, what's this? What's that? What's this? You know, on and on. They need input to figure out their world. Okay, and actually, you're really in the same circumstance right here. All right, so the whole architecture, the chemical basis of the brain is to learn, but the brain itself doesn't really know what's beneficial for the person. Okay, it just wants to learn. And one of the things that a brain can learn, for instance, is a kind of a terrible disease, and that is having seizures, like epileptic seizures. Obviously, an epileptic seizure is totally not a good thing to maintain homeostasis in a body. An epileptic seizure is characterized by massive depolarizations, namely sodium channels opening up in the brain all over the brain. So massive amounts of neurons depolarize, right, which then cause muscle contractions all over the body, can disrupt breathing and swallowing and things like that. And an important way to treat epilepsy is to be very aggressive with the treatment. After the first episode, treatment has to be very effective and instituted immediately, because what is the brain actually doing as somebody's having an epileptic seizure? The brain is actually learning how to have an epileptic seizure. So that means the second time, if the stimulus is applied, what happens? It's easier to go into a seizure. And the third time is what? Even easier than the second time. And the fourth time is even easier than the third time. Right? So it's very important to treat that kind of pathology very aggressively so that the person's brain doesn't learn how to produce epileptic seizures. And what we found, say, with clinical depression, the exact same circumstance applies. Okay, the first time somebody is depressed, it might be due to some very traumatic event in their life, maybe the death of a loved one, very tragic death or something, and normally you're going to be depressed when that happens. But what does the brain do? It learns how to produce that state. So what about the second episode? It doesn't have to be nearly as traumatic to produce that depressed state. And what about the third event? Right? Even less of a stimulus, so that a brain, after a number of stimuli, a brain actually learns to go into a depressed state with what? Hardly any kind of traumatic event whatsoever. So with depression, it's very important to treat it aggressively the very first time to what? To prevent recurrence. So that's really something that's, and that really ties into what? How marvelously the brain really learns things. It has important implications on how we treat people. So that's secondary to the initial stimulus, sure. Yeah. Okay. So, let's see, did we talk about this slide already? Oh yeah, not exactly. Right, so what can we use as antidepressants? Okay. Monoamine oxidase inhibitors are good antidepressants because they potentiate the effect of norepinephrine, which is inhibited, right? Its release is inhibited when somebody is depressed. All right. So let's look at this G protein coupled reaction right here, which is a nice scheme for monoamine neurotransmitters. So all monoamine neurotransmitters operate through this G protein coupled receptor. So don't forget, here's the G protein, here's the receptor. There's two separate entities right here. So here is norepinephrine. And we see that it binds to a receptor on the extracellular side of the plasma membrane. So what could you tell me about norepinephrine? What can you tell me about norepinephrine? Is it hydrophilic or hydrophobic kind of molecule? It is hydrophilic, meaning it can't get inside the cell. Right? It is a messenger. It's being sent by another cell. Right, but it can't get inside, so it has to bind to something on the outside of the cell, right? A receptor on the outside of the plasma membrane, but it's got to change something inside the cell. Right, and what it's going to produce inside the cell is something called cyclic AMP. So the first messenger is norepinephrine. That's going to cause the buildup of a second messenger inside the cell. And in this particular case, it's going to be cyclic AMP. And that's all because norepinephrine is a hydrophilic compound. All right, so it binds to the receptor that activates the G protein, which can break away from the receptor, dissociate, and in this particular case, the alpha subunit bumps into an enzyme that's dissolved into the plasma membrane. And this enzyme is called adenylate cyclase. Adenylate cyclase on the inside surface of the membrane will take an ATP, break off two phosphates, and it will be left with adenosine monophosphate, but in a special configuration. It leaves it in a cyclic form. Right? And that cyclic form of AMP is a very important signaling molecule, and we call that a second messenger. So what's the first messenger? Norepinephrine. That's outside the cell. It's trapped outside the cell. Cyclic AMP is the second messenger that is trapped inside the cell. And cyclic AMP performs a function of taking a protein kinase. What does a protein kinase do? It's an enzyme that phosphorylates other enzymes inside or proteins inside the cell. Cyclic AMP binds to protein kinase and turns it into an active form. And it runs around phosphorylating various kinds of proteins inside the cell, and it might actually phosphorylate ion channel. And when this ion channel is phosphorylated, that's like what, poking you in the side, it changes conformation, and this ion channel opens up as a result of that. So this is what we call a cascade mechanism due to this protein-coupled second messenger system. All right, so let's consider this adenylate cyclase. What, this is an enzyme. See, there's ASE right here at the end of the word. Now, what happens to an enzyme when it catalyzes a reaction? When it catalyzes ATP into cyclic AMP? Does it go away? Does the enzyme get degraded? No, it can catalyze the reaction, what? Over and over and over and over as long as this alpha subunit is bound to it. Okay? So it can produce thousands of cyclic AMPs, thousands of second messengers inside the cell. But what was the initial signal? Norepinephrine. How many norepinephrines?
One.
Just one. All right, so the initial signal was producing one molecule, right? But that resulted in thousands of second messengers. So what do we call it when you take a little signal and make a big signal out of it? What do you need at home in your stereo to do that? You need an amplifier, right? So when you have a cascade mechanism like this, you have a level of amplification of the signal. So you have just a tiny signal outside the cell producing what? A huge signal inside the cell, which means that it can produce a huge change inside the cell. Not only that, okay, but since this is a cascade, if you build up a lot of cyclic AMP, what, it activates another enzyme over here. Now, does this go away?
No,
this produces another level of amplification. Right, so you can have thousands and thousands of levels of amplification when you have this cascade system, so it can open up, right, many, many, many channels as a result of just one signal molecule. And then that's really going to change the membrane potential inside the cell. Right, so a cascade has that inherent mechanism of amplification as a result because these enzymes don't get degraded right away. Okay, so this is it. We're going to start with serotonin next time. All right, so on this slide, I want you to know what converts ATP to cyclic AMP. Adenylate cyclase, right? Adenylate cyclase. And then you should know that cyclic AMP is that second messenger. Okay.